UNFTR.
Let me take this opportunity to define for you, simply and straightforwardly, what democratic socialism means to me. It means building on what Franklin Delano Roosevelt said when he fought for guaranteed economic rights for all Americans. And it builds on what Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1968 when he stated, and I quote, "This country has socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor."
This is the story of a political pundit who looked at the world around him and just said, fuck it. Gives the middle finger to authority and says, kiss my ass. But instead of a revolution, he started a podcast. It's just what the world needs.
He started a podcast.
Another basic white guy who
started a podcast.
But it's fun because he curses.
All through the podcast.
I'm fucking the
And Fucking the Republic is brought to you by overcaffeinated members Nathan Sirst, Nettie Hooker One, Pete M, Rob Nasby, Rodrigo G, Ryan F, Sultan, Specker, Terry C, the younger PDX Squatch, William N, W. Jeremy D, and the memory of Nettie McGee.
Welcome to the first in our series on socialism. To do this right, we're going to have to let go of the stories we tell ourselves. Ask how things came to be. Be curious and scientific, not doctrinal or emotional. For example, if you consider yourself aligned with socialist principles, can you step back and view the marvels a capitalist system has delivered? Can you, as a capitalist, look critically at the harm? Can we ascribe values to these observations and ask whether they reflect standard moral and ethical norms we want reflected in our society? Can we accept that ideals attempting to form a general framework for society cannot be static and must evolve and iterate? At its core, this approach is known as Hegelian dialectic, the study of opposites and constant flow. G.W.F. Hegel was one of the greatest influences on Karl Marx, himself inspired by the work of ancient Greece philosopher Heraclitus, the philosopher behind the notion that no person can step into the same river twice. The river changes. It's in constant flow. We are as well. The point is, you cannot evaluate a system simply by what it was intended to produce. You must also place a value on its unintended consequences. Moreover, no system is static. Under capitalism, the world has experienced technological innovations at a rate never before experienced in human history. Medicine, communications, manufacturing, transportation. Nearly every element of society the world over has been impacted in a significant way under the system of capitalism. Along the way, these things have also altered the nature of capitalism. Capitalism is a different river, and we a different people. But if we're to be true, impartial observers, we must also ask whether or not capitalism is responsible for such growth and innovation. Would society have developed in such profound ways under another system? All worthwhile questions and pathways. But this is a discussion about socialism. So we have to establish a foundation and some definitions despite the constantly changing nature of systems. And from this foundation, we can develop key questions with the tacit agreement between us that some are unanswerable. But we can take comfort in knowing that a lack of an answer shouldn't frustrate our quest for one. It merely recognizes the river for what it is. Now, the reason I began talking about capitalism is because socialism is fundamentally a critique of capitalism. Most socialist critiques are similar in nature. The variations of socialist ideology come with the prescriptions for evolving beyond capitalism. Much like our river analogy, the order and approach to this series is subject to change based upon revelations through studying and feedback. But as of now, I have 4 episodes planned in a series to try and deconstruct this amazing topic. Part 1 will be level setting. Definitions of key concepts, the history and evolution of thinking, the economics of socialism, and the intersection of political, economic, social, and cultural aspects of the theory. Next, we'll cover major figures of socialism, from the philosophical drivers and those who added critical elements along the way, to the proponents and the detractors. Part 3 will cover the labyrinth of related systems and the myriad expressions of socialism in different regions of the world. And then, we'll conclude with the American experience specifically. The influence of organized labor, significant figures, and the evolution of socialist critique in American culture. It's possible that we'll fit a conclusion into the final episode that addresses the current status of socialism through multiple lenses and how it might continue to evolve in the future. Or, you know, maybe it'll be an epilogue similar to what we did in the Carter years. We'll see as we go.
UNFTR is also sponsored by overcaffeinated members Alfie and Flash, Awesome A, Asshole, Brie X, Cindy S, David MJ, Eric Wagner 101, Goat, G Wookie of Ohio, Joa, Cringy, Marco F, Maria from PR, Matthew, Michelle H, and Nathan E.
Chapter 1, Audience Feedback and Answers.
Laying this out ahead of time has given us an opportunity to be collaborative. And as we go, I'd love to hear your feedback and questions to make sure that we're scratching all of those intellectual itches. To kick things off, I asked unfuckers in the Facebook group and the YouTube community to provide a basic definition of socialism as if they were explaining it to a young person. And as usual, your responses were wonderful. So kicking us off is Nicholas Walton, who said, "Socialism is an economic system where the government of a country nationalizes and controls all its industries."
Stephen Whitfield said, "Socialism is the idea of using the government to channel the profit of industry to the benefit of all the citizens that make that industry possible. A government, its citizens, and its businesses must work with one another to function properly."
Trakushin said, "I would explain it to my little girl as a government that takes money through taxes and redistributes it back to the people, whether through infrastructure like roads, healthcare, education, or just basic welfare concepts like food and housing."
Now, Nathan S. said, "The equitable sharing of resources in a society, to each according to his or her needs."
CBB says, "What about this? Public streets and roads and highways versus privately owned streets and roads and highways." The quote-unquote comedian Bill Maher stated something like, "Americans love socialism, they just don't like to call it that." He also remarked that if you take a trip in your car, you don't have to bring your own highway, or something to that effect. I do not remember his exact words.
Alex Powers said, "Socialism is the abolition of the employer-employee dichotomy, and a period in which the state exists not to serve the capitalist class, but the working class, actively confronting the interests of the ruling class. It is the next step on the path to a moneyless, classless, stateless society."
Now we have Dan Garcia, who said, "I must cite David Pakman in explaining what I also believe. Social democracy versus democratic socialism. Similar words in a different order. I feel this needs to be clarified in order to understand the misinformation and demonizing of the term, especially by the right. Democratic socialism is a form of socialism where one seeks to socialize ownership of the means of production. Social democracy is a highly regulated form of capitalism, like we see in European and Nordic countries. Very different things. Progressivism in 2023, with social democracy, would consider democratic socialism as an actual form of socialism. But that is different. We're no longer talking about a capitalist organization of that society. Talking about social democracy, you're talking about socializing more things than we socialize in most modern capitalist countries. Like we've socialized the military. We've socialized early education, but need to go farther. We've socialized some healthcare, like the VA and Medicaid. We're also talking about socializing more things, but still within a capitalist country. Democratic socialism would be something beyond that, but it would have some version of socializing ownership of the means of production, businesses, etc., on a national level. And that is the socialism in which many on the right fearmonger with."
And Nelson Silva Corriero says, "I believe this can be an incredibly difficult topic to explain, but at the same time, such a simple one. Simplest in form, an elected leadership based on creating an environment where fair and equal opportunity and also responsibility is given to all citizens, where the overall health of the society is put above anyone's own interests. Everyone participating keeps the possibility of a high quality of life for their communities as high as possible. Health, education, social nets, etc., all offered as a right."
Matthew Dwyer said, "Socialism is recognition that some sectors are off limits to the profit motive. Full stop."
And our buddy Bob Knudsen said, "I think of the general philosophy of socialism as an understanding and acting on the knowledge that all in society live better when top-down authoritarian systems that overproportionate the rewards or money to the few at the top are limited or eliminated altogether. Co-ops instead of corporations, in a nutshell.
Jim Moynihan chimes in and says, socialism is a term of opprobrium in America used by business interests to denigrate most expansion of government activity other than a larger defense budget.
Nigo Gonzalez said, socialism is a means of organization that prefers systems and solutions that benefit the community as a whole over the well-being of any given individual. This generally means that said systems and solutions are designed, created, managed, and owned by the community itself, rather than by any given individual. The end result is a community more focused on equity than rapacity.
Charles Morris said, a society collectively caring for its members most in need.
Bobster Jones says, fair and equal pay, health care, emergency services. Rich people pay more to help the poor. It's just like Jesus taught us in Sunday school.
Ricky Mitchell said, when the people own the means of production. In this day and age, I imagine that whenever a corporation needs a bailout, when subsidies go toward the oil companies or animal agriculture, etc., using our tax dollars, of course, the people would own a portion of that company. Those payouts would be used to better our communities.
Nate Bedock said, socialism is a constructed economy that evenly distributes the wealth of a nation. This is why healthcare for all isn't socialism. This is why any of our social safety nets, think fire, police, EMS, aren't actually socialist policies. Please make a firm distinction that what the far right calls socialism isn't actually socialism.
Marcus Cleary shared a meme that said, quote, if a monkey hoarded more bananas than it could eat while most of the other monkeys starved, scientists would study that monkey to figure out what was wrong with it. When humans do it, we put them on the cover of Forbes.
Carol Habel said, socialism to me means everyone should be equal before the law, that taxation should be shared revenue so that each individual has the resources and wealth needed to live and live well. Public money, taxes, should protect everyone's health and well-being, funding our schools, healthcare, emergency services, transportation, social nets, food assistance, veteran services, utilities, etc. The social systems for the core population, so that individual freedom for equal opportunity is denied to no one. These resources should protect ordinary Americans in their unique cultures, traditions, and family values as an investment in a healthier, more productive nation in all its diversity.
And our buddy Will Watkins, hold for it.
I am William Wallace.
Said, the concept that a society's method of distributing resources is done in a way that benefits individuals in that society in the most equitable manner, protecting and ensuring basic human needs of food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, and access to capital are the fundamental core principles of a society. In addition, the civil rights relating to free speech, press, association, travel, and petition of government of the individuals of that society and their ability to engage in democratic processes should have the fewest frictions as possible.
Robert McDermott, a.k.a. Bobby McD, says socialism is where everyone gets education and health care while their dignity is protected into retirement and beyond. This happens because rich people pay a fair share of taxes and aren't allowed to whine about it. Of course, it's not perfect. The rich still get away with stuff, but nothing like they do in your kleptocracy masquerading as a democracy, republic, whatever the fuck fever dream you're currently experiencing. I find it so tragically funny that my political views are considered moderate here in Ireland, but in your clusterfuck of a country, I'd be a loony lefty radical communist.
K. Michael Grove said, employee-owned workplace, democracy in the workplace.
Dan Martin said, well, I tried my best and couldn't do it in a single sentence or two, so here's three, plus an example. Socialism is an inversion of capitalist risk-reward model where workers democratically elect their management and decide how to share the risks and profits, as well as the use of the commons in production. To protect the commons, banking under socialism is controlled centrally to subsidize growth and development, or degrowth, to account for externalities beyond the scope of the workplace. The commons are inputs used in production other than human labor. For example, centrally controlled banks would subsidize public transportation to promote its growth and development, recognizing the poor use of resources and unsustainable polluting effects of personal vehicles, which are disproportionately borne by those who benefit least.
And Snail Powered said, socialism is acting in the interest of the good of a group before personal gain. That is probably overly simplistic, but I think it truly encapsulates how it's used most often. Jimmy Carter may not have been a socialist, but I feel that it is undeniable that he practiced socialism as a leader. I found that during my time as a leader in the U.S. Army, this definition of socialism is also what inspired men to follow me. I think I went over a sentence or two. It's all good, snail powered. It's all good. Chapter 2: The Importance of Being Bernie.
So just this small experiment illustrates the challenge in defining something as broad as socialism. In these extraordinary responses, we can begin to understand the complexity of systems design. We heard political and economic themes.
Concepts like fairness and equity.
Class struggle, social constructs.
Corporate systems, issues pertaining to basic rights, civil, human, natural, and legal.
Expressions of social constructs like dignity and morality, centralized planning, nationalization.
These are all aspects of socialism and the duality of defining it as an economic system and ideology. And there's crossover between the two, with ideological concepts informing economic structures and vice versa. Now, before we dig into the actual definitions and begin to dissect both the economic and ideological frameworks from a historical perspective, let's first look at how socialism is addressed in our current society. And again, I'm just speaking about the United States in particular, but we do have a great influence over the dialogue in the world. So, perhaps the best way to do this is to peer through the lens of the mainstream media, which acts as both a reflection of our beliefs and a megaphone. While talking about socialism is no longer as taboo in this nation as it was during the Cold War era, it's still difficult to find honest discourse outside of niche outlets. To demonstrate this, let's first listen to how socialism is spoken about on the establishment liberal mouthpiece MSNBC. The first clip that you're going to hear is from Lawrence O'Donnell, himself a prominent liberal media figure who has publicly stated that he is a socialist, despite his establishment credentials.
Socialism in the 1950s in America became a bad word. And we then became anti-intellectual about socialism. We as a country stopped thinking about what it actually is and just adopted, for the most part, a posture of fear against the word and the concept socialism. And so, when Medicare was proposed in the 1960s, the argument against it was essentially it's socialism. That was the entire argument. And it was kind of surprising that that argument didn't work, especially because it was true. Medicare is socialism, and everyone on Medicare in this country is the beneficiary of a very smart socialistic program called Medicare.
So that's about as honest an assessment as you'll hear from a mainstream figure on the proverbial left. But even though he's a fixture on MSNBC, this clip is from C-SPAN. Now, I have no doubt that aspects of socialist theory creep into O'Donnell's signature op-eds on his program, but they're certainly not readily accessible. Now, this next clip is from Chuck Todd, on the other hand, and it's far more indicative of the manner in which socialism is addressed by even the most supposedly left-leaning mainstream outlet.
Well, that got us thinking about some other isms and its that could use some redefining if being social makes you a socialist. If you like to commune with people, does that make you a communist? How about if you're into fashion? Are you now a fascist? Perhaps you're left-handed. Guess that makes you a leftist. Or say you're a business person who dictates letters. Dictator, anyone?
Aside from the fact that Chuck Todd probably won't be headlining any comedy clubs near you anytime soon, this strikes at the heart of how socialism is generally dismissed, even among liberals. On the other end of the spectrum, we have the constant din of anti-socialist rhetoric in the right-wing media and political ecosystem.
Democrats want to bring socialism to America. It makes me wonder, do they want to destroy America?
The effects of socialism and communism seem remote, like a hangover you had from tequila back when you were 16. You threw up for 2 days and swore never again. But in a year, you do.
The rise of socialism has never been more clear. Right now in America, there are forces dug in, organized, and well-funded, doing whatever is necessary to make socialism happen.
Billionaire and Home Depot co-founder Bernie Marcus is blasting socialism, rightly so, for making things worse because socialism sucks.
One of the most serious challenges our countries face is the specter of socialism. It's the wrecker of nations and destroyer of society.
I reject Marxism, Leninism, communism, any of these isms that have come out of of a political theory that basically denies the worth of each and every individual.
Capitalism is good because capitalism is freedom. Socialism is bad because socialism is tyranny. Not it's an aspect of tyranny. Socialism itself is tyranny.
Neither the casual nor devout consumer of mainstream news is ever really confronted with serious dialogue about ideology and political theory. So the information about socialism, as just one example, is either delivered in a bemused and dismissive tone on the left or vituperative tone on the right. It's why Bernie's presidential bids were seismic in terms of influence on our language and culture. Bernie's steady drumbeat of messaging regarding inequality, the 1%, universal health care, and student debt relief were vital. By pointing out the byproducts of a denigrated capitalist system, he was able to open hearts and minds to evaluating other political and economic modalities without the need to expressly criticize capitalism or promote socialism. In fact, I would argue that one of the reasons Bernie's message resonated to the degree that it did is that he never expressly advocated for socialism. Even now, past his presidential candidacy years, he's still cautious about the framing of his ideas. His new book, for example, is titled, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, which might be the harshest criticism that he's offered. It's not called Capitalism Failed, Death to Capitalism, Down with Capitalism, just It's Okay to Be Angry. But he's particularly good about the calling out of people who take advantage of the system. The uber wealthy, the oligarchs, the 1%, millionaires and billionaires. And when he takes capitalism to task, it's usually couched in language that blames the wealthy for corrupting the system, not the system itself. Even his framing as a democratic socialist was a high wire act, and one that's actually false. As listener Dan Garcia points out, in the United States, we have the concept of social democracy and democratic socialism backwards. Social democracy, sometimes referred to as market socialism, seeks to construct socialist systems on top of a market-based system that preserves private property, markets to determine price and production, wage labor, and shareholder capital. Democratic socialism, or classical socialism, on the other hand, takes a more Marxian approach to organizing economic systems such as labor-owned production and centralized planning. It's not that Bernie was being disingenuous, and I'm not sure how much semantics matter to even the most curious member of the public. I just think that it was far easier to build a national platform around the term democratic socialism, and once it started, it was too late to shift gears. But since we're placing so much emphasis on the importance of language, it's worth making the distinction here. Either way, what Bernie accomplished is not to be understated. Over the past dozen years or so, he has helped mainstream ideas that were the third rail in the United States, not even for discussion in polite company. Stuff that was spoken about on college campuses, and barely so. Maybe incorporated into white papers at left-leaning nonprofits and think tanks. That's why I think he took such a measured linguistic approach, always refraining from stating that capitalism is a failed system, stopping short of calling for a socialist revolution. Using terms like uber-capitalism, socialism for the rich, democratic socialism, social safety nets, Scandinavian models, corrupt oligarchy, corporatism, etc. But now that these ideas have once again been released into the wild, and younger generations especially are willing to examine the merit of systems other than capitalism, we've reached an interesting point in capitalist history. Most thinking people understand that what we have now, no matter what you want to call it, capitalism, corporatism, oligarchy, inverted totalitarianism, whatever, it's not working. Inequality is widening. Entire systems keep failing over and over. The pandemic exposed the fragile nature of globalism and trade. And oh, by the way, we're cooking the planet. Strictly speaking of the United States, and this isn't being ethnocentric, just pragmatic as we remain the key driver of the global economy. The immediate future looks bleak in terms of leadership, with Joe Biden seeking a second term and what is shaping up to be the most evil cast of characters ever assembled running against him. And I get it that it's frustrating and a lot of shit can happen in just a few years. But I truly believe that the 2008 financial crisis, the Occupy movement in 2011, and the rise of Bernie Sanders, potentially, emphasis on potentially, ushered us into a new era, brimming with opportunity to evaluate the history of economic and social systems in order to design new ones. But as we've said before, how can you know where you're going if you don't know from whence you came? And before we can even get there, we have to know what the hell we're talking about.
Chapter 3, A Brief Overview of Crucial Concepts.
As we saw with the confusion surrounding social democracy versus democratic socialism, it's important to nail down a few key concepts and terms as we move through this discussion. As we'll cover in upcoming chapters, the language and the concepts surrounding socialism have evolved over time. The most enduring contributions to our general understanding, however, come from Karl Marx. So much of what we'll pull from is largely attributed to his work in Das Kapital, the Communist Manifesto, and various other works completed by Friedrich Engels after Marx's death. Importantly, the roots of socialism predate Marx, but one of his great contributions was to define certain ideas and build them into an economic framework. At the time Marx was writing, he viewed the classes in the capitalist system generally as the working class, or proletariat, and the bourgeoisie. The workers and laborers comprised the proletariat, and the owners of capital, sometimes referred to by Marx as the guardians, were the bourgeoisie. Later on, the rise of the service and merchant class, those who stand to profit from trade but still lack the status of a capital guardian, would develop into the petty bourgeoisie. While it may seem elementary to us today, one of his great innovations was in valuing capital. In the simplest of terms, prior to this period, commodities were viewed in terms of their use value, what the raw form of a material is worth. The exchange value is its value in a transaction. Prior to Marx defining value in such terms, most models strictly considered use value and attempted to equate quantifiable values between commodities. X amount of corn is worth Y amount of iron, as he proposes in Das Kapital. But the process of turning a material into something with an exchange value, or its worth in the marketplace, involves a degree of labor to transform it from its natural state. As he writes, quote, "The value of a commodity, therefore, varies directly as the quantity and inversely as the productiveness of the labor incorporated into it," end quote. So again, it sounds super simple, but it's hugely important to understanding the roots of what will be ultimately his critique of the entire capitalist system. By valuing the inputs of labor and crediting this ingredient as that which gives exchange value to a commodity, he makes labor the central economic ingredient in the value of production, or as he calls it, quote, "incorporating living labor with their dead substance," end quote.
When we talk about the means of production, another central element to economic theory, we're talking about everything involved in bringing a product to market. Tools to extract raw materials, transport of materials and goods, the equipment used to add value to a raw material. Essentially everything outside of the raw material and the labor required to convert it into something worthy of an exchange value.
One of the keys to differentiating between capitalism and various forms of socialism is an understanding of private property. Essentially, who owns the means of production? Who owns the tools, the factories, the machines, the transportation, etc.?
In a capitalist society, it's pretty straightforward. The guardian class owns the means of production and therefore determines how it's used. In a socialist society, the workers themselves would theoretically own the means of production, thereby stripping the guardian class of such private property. This is one key distinction we can make, for example, between modern social democracy and democratic socialism. The former would still allow for the existence of private property, but utilize state programs of taxation to redistribute the surplus capital derived from production. The latter would flow directly to the working class. Now, all of this paints a small picture within a much larger system. And if we jump ahead in our timeline to when the Bolsheviks took control of Russia and attempted to convert from a feudal economy to a collective, the concept was theoretically based on a more democratic socialist style economy. In fact, the word Soviet is essentially a local, democratically elected council that theoretically determines the governance and economic activities of a defined region. Again, in theory, this democratic process would give ownership and authority to control the economy and grant quasi-ownership of the means of production. The vision of a union of all of these disparate Soviets controlling pieces of a large system was the genesis of the Soviet Union. Now, later on, we'll discuss how this concept never really came to fruition, but just the idea of it is an approximation historians have to how the working class could own the political and economic process within a larger system. Building on this, the natural question arises of how exactly labor-owned and controlled operations would participate in the larger economy and theoretically thrive under a political system. That's where the theories begin to diverge even more. Again, as we move through the series, we'll give examples of different interpretations and systems that evolved from attempting to answer questions like this. But for now, we're still in the definitions and level setting phase. So let's continue with a few key questions because we can already see how complications would arise along the way to building out a socialist infrastructure, not only within a defined territory, but in terms of how this economic system would fit into a global marketplace. Here are just a few questions that illustrate the complexity of these theories.
If market forces such as supply and demand aren't solely responsible for determining price, then how are goods and services valued?
How do you determine output?
We're used to the idea that the price of something is what the market will bear, or that people are willing to pay for it. Under a socialist system, who values the inputs such as labor and raw materials?
If ownership of property and the means of production is distributed among the working class, how do we determine the value of a share? Is skilled labor worth the same as unskilled labor?
Where does capital investment come from, if not the markets and the bourgeoisie?
If surplus values, the amount above the value of labor and material inputs, is split among the working class, then how are deficits accounted for?
We're conditioned to believe that innovation is fostered by the desire for capital accumulation. Under a socialist system, what are the key incentives to innovate if all surplus wealth is distributed evenly?
We're also conditioned to believe that scarcity increases value and abundance detracts from it. If scarcity is a market force, then does it still exist in the absence of a free market? Does it even matter?
Attempts to answer these and many other questions naturally involve government intervention to a large degree. Some believe that many of these questions are indeed answered with a centralized planning model, whereby outputs are predetermined by central authorities that set fixed production amounts. Modern-day China is a great example of this. The Soviet Union was a bad example. What's the difference? In the years following the Cuban Revolution, centralized planning looked like it was paying dividends. Then came the lean years, or the special period as the Cubans called it, when centralized planning failed and their primary market collapsed with the fall of the Soviet Union. Some believe that you can have decentralized planning in terms of output and control over the means of production, but it's difficult to point to enduring examples of success. Students of economic and social theory will recognize our discussion thus far as pretty basic. But again, it's important to establish a common vocabulary and to frame inquiries in a way that contextualizes the challenges different theories present in the world. From here, we can build on the key concepts and terms such as labor, surplus, means of production, centralized planning, scarcity, and so on, to see how socialist theory was interpreted at different times throughout its history. For the real aficionados, I promise this will get deeper as we go. As a preview, we'll cover notable figures such as César Beccaria, Jeremy Bentham, Henri de Saint-Simon, Robert Owen, Charles Fourier, Mikhail Bakunin, John Stuart Mill, John Dewey, Rosa Luxemburg, Peter Kropotkin, Karl Kautsky, Emma Goldman, right through to Michael Harrington, and even Bernie. We'll introduce many of these characters in the next episode when we examine distinct epochs of socialist history, beginning with the real socialist roots that predate Marx. So with key concepts and terms under our belt, we'll build our timeline and bring central characters into the mix on our way to distinguishing between socialism, Marxism, communism, anarchism, utopian socialism, Maoism, Leninism, Stalinism, democratic socialism, and more. We'll add even more color to the discussion by evaluating historical examples in Cuba, China, Scandinavia, Russia, Africa, and Latin America. Then we'll focus specifically on the United States as a microcosm of all of these approaches, concepts, movements, key figures, timeline, and an evaluation of where things stand today. So I'm really excited to go on this journey with you. One favor is to please continue sending in questions and suggestions. We're going to be at this for a while, so it's important that this is a collaborative process. And the best way to do that is to fill out the contact form on UNFTR.com or hit me up in the community tab on YouTube. So, that's it for now. Thanks for jumping into the river with us. Hopefully, when we emerge, we will indeed be different, as no doubt the river will be. Here endeth part one of Understanding Socialism.
It's the end of the episode where we used to do show notes. Now we just talk through a few things. Reflect on what was said or what we should have done instead. Oh, post-show musings.
Welcome to Post-Show Musings, everybody. Now, between us, here's where I'd like to end up. There is some really important philosophical work being done right now and in recent years. Work that I really think that we need to cover. But it's hard to just kind of jump in without historical context and perspective. Now, we do a pretty good job at uncovering counter-narratives and destructive elements of society, but not enough talking about how to actually unfuck things, as our name implies. They go hand in hand, obviously, but my goal here is to do more than just give a history lesson in a timeline of something that has been written about 1,000 times over and by people way smarter than me. My goal is to build towards something.
You finally grown out that beard and going into the woods to work on your manifesto?
Something like that. I mean, I really want to bring new work to light, you know, work that isn't covered as much, and examine new political and economic frameworks that incorporate the great minds of the past. And so I'm thinking of David Schweikart, Michael Albert, Esther Duflo, Thomas Piketty, Bernard Harcourt. These are modern theorists that interest me greatly as they're attempting to understand what a post-capitalist global economy could look like. One that places anti-poverty initiatives and ecological sustainability at the center. This is the big thinking that we've been talking about. And I feel like the more we understand about what's possible, based upon what is known about the destructive nature of capitalism, the better equipped we will be to press our public servants into action and to shape policy moving forward. I'm interested to hear who unfuckers believe will be at the forefront of new political and economic thought. And that is the experiment for now. So how do you feel about the kickoff so far, 99?
I think it's great. A lot to chew on. So maybe we should send the unfuckers on their way.
Okay.
Right?
Yep, you bet. Well, that's it for now. As always, Unfucking the Republic is
edited and arranged
by the sound design maestro,
Many Faces.
It's produced by the all-powerful, warm, wonderful, brilliant 99. And you are really all of those things.
Thank you.
How's your back?
Haven't had any complaints.
I'm Max. I'm your host. You can find me here, or you can find me on YouTube. Go to youtube.com/@ at UNFTR. That's where they can find it, right?
Yeah. Go to the website, unftr.com. Become a member at buymeacoffee.com/UNFTR. Look at our book list. All of that is linked for you at unftr.com. Make sure to sign up for our newsletter, unftr.com/blog. I think those are all the places.
Yeah, follow many thanks to Tom McGovern, by the way, who produces all of the original music that can be heard on this show. Tom McGovern continues to take off. His social media is just on fire lately.
He played at the strike in his band.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Outside of Paramount, I believe, playing.
That's a good way to get found, actually, right?
Yeah. All the people who think you're funny are right there.
Exactly. So that's it for now on Fuckers. I'll catch you on the YouTubes. We'll see you next week with show notes as well. And here we go. This is going to be a long journey. And I said there'll be 4, but I probably lied. My guess is we're going to be doing this all year long, interspersed with some other.
All summer long.
Yeah. Interspersed with some other stuff, but obviously, I got some shit on my mind right now. The Supreme Court is going to deliver a lot of fodder for us. We've got the decision about indigenous adoption. So in native country, I think that might be a disaster. We can probably follow up on affirmative action when that gets struck down as well.
Yep. Still looking to see who the best resource is, because somebody who's involved with it wouldn't answer my emails. Does he know who he's talking to?
How dare they?
I know. It's like you have like a full-time real job or something and you have things to do before you retire.
Ridiculous.
I know. But we'll find somebody. We've gotten great suggestions, so did not forget about that. But
we're also recording this the day after Ron DeSantis's disastrous announcement with Elon Musk.
Good.
That he's running for president. started out with 500,000 people apparently in the feed. They dropped out.
525,600 viewers.
And then by the time they got back on and kicked half of the people out, there were 250,000. And most of them were just hearing Elon Musk talk about how shit wasn't working. So that's fun.
Classic.
And so much more. So going to be a great summer. Socialism's going to carry the day and having, keep us through the year here.
We're having socialism girl summer.
Ooh, is that
socialist
like,
girl summer?
Especially like hot, girl, hot girl summer.
Yeah.
I love it.
Socialist day summer.
It's like the least hot summer you could possibly have. Catch you later on Fuckers.
Bye. You with me when they be asking where you at. I can't read your mind, gotta say that. Take your love, should I take that? Got a whole lot of options, cause you know.